metabolized into glucose, lactose, and glycogen. The body handles excess glucose consumption through several well-defined metabolic pathways, such as glycogen storage and de novo lipogenesis, creation of new fat. No such system is present for fructose. The more you eat, the more you metabolize. The bottom line is that excess fructose is changed into fat in the liver. High levels of fructose will cause fatty liver. Fatty liver is absolutely crucial to the development of insulin resistance in the liver. That fructose directly causes insulin resistance was discovered long ago. As far back as 1980, experiments proved that fructose, but not glucose, caused the development of insulin resistance in humans. Healthy subjects were given an extra 1,000 calories per day of either glucose or fructose. The glucose group showed no change in insulin sensitivity. The fructose group, however, showed a 25% worsening of their insulin sensitivity after just 7 days. A 2009 study showed that prediabetes could be induced in healthy volunteers in only 8 weeks. Healthy subjects ate 25% of their daily calories as Kool-Aid sweetened with either glucose or fructose. While this seems high, many people consume this high proportion of sugar in their diets. With its low glycemic index, fructose raised blood glucose much less. The fructose, but not the glucose group, developed prediabetes by 8 weeks. Insulin levels as well as measures of insulin resistance were significantly higher in the fructose group. So only 6 days of excess fructose will cause insulin resistance. By 8 weeks, prediabetes is establishing a beachhead. What happens after decades of high fructose consumption? Fructose overconsumption leads directly to insulin resistance. Mechanisms. Insulin is normally released when we eat. It directs some of the incoming glucose to be used as energy and some to be stored for later use. In the short term, glucose is stored as glycogen in the liver, but the liver's storage space for glycogen is limited. Once it's full, excess glucose is stored as fat. That is, the liver begins manufacturing fat from glucose through de novo lipogenesis. After the meal, as insulin levels fall, this process reverses. With no food energy coming in, stored food energy must be retrieved. Glycogen and fat stores in the liver are turned back into glucose and distributed to the rest of the body for energy. The liver acts like a balloon. As energy comes in, it fills up. As energy is needed, it deflates. Balancing feeding and fasting periods over a day ensures that no net fat is gained or lost. But what happens if the liver is already crammed full of fat? Insulin then tries to force more fat and sugar into the liver, even though it's already full of fat and sugar. Just as it is more difficult to inflate a fully inflated balloon, insulin has more difficulty trying to shove more fat into a fatty liver. It takes higher and higher levels of insulin to move the same amount of food energy into a fatty liver. The body is now resistant to the efforts of insulin, since normal levels will not be enough to push sugar into the liver. Voila! Insulin resistance in the liver. The liver, like an overinflated balloon, will try to expel the sugar back into circulation. So continuously high insulin levels are also required to keep it bottled up in the liver. If insulin levels start to drop, the stored fat and sugar comes whooshing out. To compensate, the body keeps raising its insulin levels. Thus, insulin resistance leads to higher insulin levels. High insulin levels encourage more storage of sugar and fat in the liver, which causes even more overcramming of fat in the already fatty liver, causing more insulin resistance, A classic vicious cycle. Sucrose, a 50-50 mix of glucose and fructose, therefore plays a dual role in obesity. Glucose is a refined carbohydrate that directly stimulates insulin. Fructose overconsumption causes fatty liver, which directly produces insulin resistance. Over the longer term, insulin resistance also leads to increased insulin levels, which then feeds back to increase insulin resistance. Sucrose stimulates insulin production both in the short term and in the long term. In this way, sucrose is twice as bad as glucose. The effect of glucose is obvious in the glycemic index, but the effect of fructose is completely hidden. This fact misled scientists to downplay the role of sucrose in obesity. But the uniquely fattening effect of sugar has finally been recognized. Cutting back on sugars and sweets has always been the first step in weight reduction in virtually all diets throughout history. Sugars are not simply empty calories or refined carbohydrates. They are far more dangerous than that, as they stimulate both insulin and insulin resistance. The extra fattening effect of sugar is due to the stimulation of insulin resistance from fructose, which festers for years or even decades before it becomes obvious. Short-term feeding studies completely miss this effect, as evidenced by a recent systemic analysis. Analyzing many studies lasting less than a week, it concluded that fructose shows no special effect outside of its calories. That's analogous to analyzing smoking studies lasting several weeks and concluding that smoking does not cause lung cancer. Sugar's effects, as well as obesity, develop over decades, not days. This explains the apparent paradox of the Asian rice eater. The Intermap studies of the 1990s found that the Chinese were eating very high amounts of white rice, but suffered little obesity. The key was that their sucrose consumption was extremely low, which minimized the development of insulin resistance. Once their sucrose consumption started to increase, they began to develop insulin resistance. Combined with their original high carbohydrate intake, white rice, this was a recipe for the diabetes disaster they are facing right now. What to do? If you want to avoid weight gain, remove all added sugars from your diet. On this, at least everybody can agree. Don't replace them with artificial sweeteners, as we'll see in the next chapter. Those are equally bad. Despite all the doom and gloom of the obesity epidemic, I am actually quite optimistic that we may have turned the corner. At last, the evidence is accumulating. The relentless increase of obesity in the United States has recently started to slow, and in some states may, for the first time, begun to decline. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the rate of new cases of type 2 diabetes is also starting to slow. The reduction of dietary sugars plays no small role in this victory. Chapter 15. The Diet Soda Delusion. On a warm June night in 1879, the Russian chemist Konstantin Fahlberg sat down to dinner and bit into a remarkably sweet roll of bread. What was remarkable was that no sugar was used to make it. Earlier that day, while working on coal tar derivatives in the laboratory, an extraordinary sweet experimental compound had spilled all over his hands and then made its way into the rolls. Rushing back to the laboratory, he tasted everything in sight. He had just discovered saccharin, the world's first artificial sweetener. The search for sweeteners. Originally synthesized as a drink additive for diabetics, saccharin's popularity slowly spread, and eventually other sweet, low-calorie compounds were synthesized. Cyclamate was discovered in 1937, but later removed from use in the United States in 1970 due to concerns about bladder cancer. Aspartame, NutraSweet, was discovered in 1965. Approximately 200 times sweeter than sucrose, aspartame is one of the most notorious of sweeteners due to its cancer-causing potential in animals. Nevertheless, it gained approval for use in 1981. Aspartame's popularity has since been eclipsed by acesulfame potassium, followed by the current champion, sucralose. Diet soda is the most obvious source in our diet of these chemicals, but yogurts, snack bars, breakfast cereals, and many other sugar-free processed foods also contain them. Diet drinks contain very few calories and no sugar. Therefore, replacing a regular soft drink with a diet soda seems like a good way to reduce sugar intake and help shed some pounds. With the increasing health concerns around excess sugar, food manufacturers responded by releasing an estimated 6,000 new artificially sweetened products. The intake of artificial sweeteners has increased markedly in the U.S. population, see figure 15.1, with 20% to 25% of American adults routinely ingesting these chemicals, mostly in beverages. From humble beginnings in 1960 to the year 2000, the consumption of diet soda has increased by more than 400%. Diet Coke has long been the second most popular soft drink, just behind regular Coca-Cola. In 2010, diet drinks made up 42% of Coca-Cola's sales in the United States. Despite initial enthusiasm, though, the use of artificial sweeteners has recently leveled off, primarily due to safety concerns. Surveys indicate that 64% of respondents had some health concerns about artificial sweeteners, with 44% making a deliberate effort to reduce their intake or avoid them altogether. And so the search has been on for more natural, low-calorie sweeteners. Agave nectar enjoyed a brief surge of popularity. Agave nectar is processed from the agave plant, which grows in the southwest regions of the United States, Mexico, and parts of South America. Agave was felt to be a healthier alternative to sugar due to its lower glycemic index. Dr. Mehmet Oz, a cardiologist popular on American television, briefly touted the health benefits of agave nectar before reversing his stance when he realized it was mostly fructose, 80%. Agave's low glycemic index was simply due to its high fructose content. The next big thing to hit the market was stevia. Stevia is extracted from the leaves of Stevia rebaudiana, a plant that is native to South America. It has 300 times the sweetness of regular sugar and a minimal effect on glucose. Widely used in Japan since 1970, it has recently become available in North America. Both agave nectar and sweeteners derived from stevia are highly processed. In that regard, they are not any better than sugar itself, a natural compound derived from sugar beets. The search for proof. In 2012, both the American Diabetes Association and the American Heart Association issued a joint statement endorsing the use of low-calorie sweeteners to aid in losing weight and improving health. The American Diabetes Association states on its website, "Foods and drinks that use artificial sweeteners are another option that may help curb your cravings for something sweet." But the evidence is surprisingly scarce. Presuming that artificial low-calorie sweeteners are beneficial presents an immediate and obvious problem. Per capita consumption of diet foods has skyrocketed in recent decades. If diet drinks substantially reduce obesity or diabetes, why did these two epidemics continue unabated? The only logical conclusion is that diet drinks don't really help. There are substantial epidemiologic studies to back that up. The American Cancer Society conducted a survey of 78,694 women, hoping to find that artificial sweeteners had a beneficial effect on weight. Instead, the survey showed exactly the opposite. After adjustment for initial weight, over a one-year period, those using artificial sweeteners were significantly more likely to gain weight, although the weight gain itself was relatively modest, less than 2 pounds. Dr. Sharon Fowler, from the University of Texas Health Sciences Center at San Antonio, she found that instead of reducing the obesity, diet beverages substantially increased the risk of it by a mind-bending 47%. She writes, "These findings raise the question whether artificial sweetener use might be fueling rather than fighting our escalating obesity epidemic." The bad news for diet soda kept rolling in. Over the 10 years of the Northern Manhattan study, Dr. Hannah Gardner from the University of Miami found in 2012 that drinking diet soda was associated with a 43% increase in risk of vascular events, strokes, and heart attacks. The 2008 Atherosclerosis Risk in Communities Study, ARIC, found a 34% increased incidence of metabolic syndrome in diet soda users, which is consistent with data from the 2007 Framingham Heart Study, which showed a 50% higher incidence of metabolic syndrome. In 2014, Dr. Ankur Vyas from the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics presented a study following 59,614 women over 8.7 years in the Women's Health Initiative Observational Study. The study found a 30% increased risk of cardiovascular events, heart attacks, and strokes in those drinking two or more diet drinks daily. The benefits for heart attack, stroke, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome were similarly elusive. Artificial sweeteners are not good. They are bad. Very bad. Despite reducing sugar, diet sodas do not reduce the risk of obesity, metabolic syndrome, strokes, or heart attacks. But why? Because it is insulin, not calories, that ultimately drives obesity and metabolic syndrome. The important question is this: do artificial sweeteners increase insulin levels? Sucralose raises insulin by 20%, despite the fact that it contains no calories and no sugar. This insulin-raising effect has also been shown for other artificial sweeteners, including the natural sweetener stevia. Despite having a minimal effect on blood sugars, both aspartame and stevia raised insulin levels higher even than table sugar. Artificial sweeteners that raise insulin should be expected to be harmful, not beneficial. Artificial sweeteners may decrease calories and sugars, but not insulin. Yet, it is insulin that drives weight gain and diabetes. Artificial sweeteners may also cause harm by increasing cravings. The brain may perceive an incomplete sense of reward by sensing sweetness without calories, which may then cause overcompensation and increased appetite and cravings. Functional MRI studies show that glucose activates the brain's reward centers fully, but not sucralose. The incomplete activation could stimulate cravings for sweet food to fully activate the reward centers. In other words, you may be developing a habit of eating sweet foods, leading to overeating. Indeed, most controlled trials show that there is no reduction in caloric intake with the use of artificial sweeteners. The strongest proof of failure comes from two recent randomized trials. Dr. David Ludwig from Harvard randomly divided two groups of overweight adolescents. One group was given water and diet drinks to consume, while the control group continued with their usual drinks. At the end of 2 years, the diet soda group was consuming far less sugar than the control group. That's good, but that is not our question. Does drinking diet soda make any difference to adolescent obesity? The short answer is no. There was no significant weight difference between the two groups. Another shorter-term study involving 163 obese women randomized to aspartame did not show improved weight loss over 19 weeks. But one trial involving 641 normal weight children did find a statistically significant weight loss associated with the use of artificial sweeteners. However, the difference was not as dramatic as hoped. At the end of 18 months, there was only a 1 pound difference between the artificial sweetener group and the control group. Conflicting reports such as these often generate confusion within nutritional science. One study will show a benefit and another study will show the exact opposite. Generally, the deciding factor is who paid for the study. Researchers looked at 17 different reviews of sugar-sweetened drinks and weight gain. A full 83.3% of studies sponsored by food companies did not show a relationship between sugar-sweetened drinks and weight gain. But independently funded studies showed the exact opposite. 83.3% showed a strong relationship between sugar-sweetened drinks and weight gain. The awful truth. The final arbiter, therefore, must be common sense. Reducing dietary sugars is certainly beneficial, but that doesn't mean that replacing sugar with completely artificial, man-made chemicals of dubious safety is a good idea. Some pesticides and herbicides are also considered safe for human consumption. However, we shouldn't be going out of our way to eat more of them. Caloric reduction is the main advantage of artificial sweeteners. But it is not calories that drives obesity, it's insulin. Since artificial sweeteners also raise insulin levels, there is no benefit to using them. Eating chemicals that are not foods, such as aspartame, sucralose, or acesulfame potassium, is not a good idea. They are synthesized in large chemical vats and added to foods because they happen to be sweet and not kill you. Small amounts of glue won't kill you either. That doesn't mean we should be eating it. The bottom line is that these chemicals do not help you lose weight and may actually cause you to gain it. They may cause cravings that induce overeating of sweet foods. And continually eating sweet foods, even if they have no calories, may lead us to crave other sweet foods. The randomized trials confirm our own personal experience and common sense. Yes, drinking diet soda will reduce sugar intake. But no, it will not help reduce your weight. This, of course, you probably already knew. Consider all the people you see drinking diet sodas. Do you know anybody at all who said that drinking diet soda made him or her lose a lot of weight? Anybody at all? Chapter 16. Carbohydrates and protective fiber. Controversy surrounds the humble carbohydrate. Is it good or bad? From the mid-1950s to the 1990s, they were the good guys, the heroes. Low in fat, they were supposed to be our salvation from the epidemic of heart disease. Then the Atkins onslaught of the late 1990s recast them in the role of dietary villain. Many advocates avoided all carbohydrates, even vegetables and fruits. So, are carbohydrates good or bad? Insulin and insulin resistance drive obesity. Refined carbohydrates, such as white sugar and white flour, cause the greatest increase in insulin levels. These foods are quite fattening, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all carbohydrates are similarly bad. Good carbohydrates, whole fruits and vegetables, are substantially different from bad sugar and flour. Broccoli will likely not make you fat, no matter how much you eat. But eating even modest amounts of sugar can certainly cause weight gain. Yet both are carbohydrates. How do we distinguish the two? Glycemic index and glycemic load. Dr. David Jenkins of the University of Toronto began to tackle this problem in 1981 with the glycemic index. Foods were ranked according to their ability to raise glucose levels. Since dietary protein and fat did not raise blood glucose appreciably, they were excluded from the glycemic index, which measures only carbohydrate-containing foods. For those foods, glycemic index and insulin-stimulating effect are closely correlated. The glycemic index uses identical 50-gram portions of carbohydrate. For example, you might take foods such as carrots, watermelon, apples, bread, pancakes, a candy bar, and oatmeal. Measure out a portion of each to contain 50 grams of carbohydrate, then measure the effect on blood glucose. Then you compare the foods against the reference standard, glucose, which is assigned a value of 100. However, a standard serving of food may not contain 50 grams of carbohydrate. For example, watermelon has a very high glycemic index of 72, but contains only 5% carbohydrate by weight. Most of watermelon's weight is water. You would need to eat 1 kilogram, 2.2 pounds of watermelon to get 50 grams of carbohydrate, far in excess of what a person would eat at one sitting. A corn tortilla, though, has a glycemic index of 52. The tortilla is 48% carbohydrate by weight, so you would only have to eat 104 grams of the tortilla, close to what a person would reasonably eat during a meal, to get 50 grams of carbohydrate. The glycemic load index attempts to correct this distortion by adjusting for serving size. Watermelon turns out to have a very low glycemic load of 5, while the corn tortilla still ranks high at 25. But whether you use the glycemic index or glycemic load, you'll find there is a clear distinction between refined carbohydrates and unrefined traditional foods. Western refined foods have a very high glycemic index and glycemic load scores. Traditional whole foods have low glycemic load scores despite containing similar amounts of carbohydrate, an essential distinguishing feature. See figure 16.1. Carbohydrates are not inherently fattening. Their toxicity lies in the way they are processed. Refining significantly increases the glycemic index by purifying and concentrating the carbohydrate. Removal of fat, fiber, and protein means that the carbohydrate can be digested and absorbed very quickly. In the example of wheat, modern machine milling, which has almost completely replaced the traditional stone milling, pulverizes the wheat into the very fine white powder we know as flour. Cocaine users will know that very fine powders are absorbed into the bloodstream much faster than coarse grains. That's what allows for higher highs, both for cocaine and for glucose. Refined wheat causes our glucose levels to spike. Insulin levels follow. Second, refining encourages overconsumption. For example, making a glass of orange juice may require 4 or 5 oranges. It is very easy to drink a glass of juice, but eating 5 oranges is not so easy. By removing everything other than the carbohydrate, we tend to overconsume what is left. If we had to eat all the fiber and bulk associated with 5 oranges, we might think twice about it. The same applies to grains and vegetables. The problem is one of balance. Our bodies have adapted to the balance of nutrients in natural food. By refining foods and only consuming a certain component, the balance is entirely destroyed. People have been eating unrefined carbohydrates for thousands of years without obesity or diabetes. What's changed, and recently too, is that we now predominantly eat refined grains as our carbohydrate of choice. Wheat, the West's grain of choice. Wheat has long been a symbol of nutrition. Wheat, along with rice and corn, is one of the first domesticated foods in human history. Yet these days, what with gluten sensitivity and obesity, wheat does not have a friend to call its own. But how can wheat possibly be so bad? As discussed in Chapter 9, wheat has been cultivated since ancient times. But by the 1950s, Malthusian concerns of overpopulation and worldwide famine arose again. Norman Borlaug, who would later win the Nobel Peace Prize, began experimenting with higher-yield wheat varieties, and thus was born the dwarf wheat variety. Today, an estimated 99% of all wheat grown worldwide is dwarf or semi-dwarf varieties. But where Dr. Borlaug bred naturally occurring strains together, successors quickly turned to new technologies to enhance mutations. The new varieties of wheat were not tested for safety, but were merely assumed to be safe in this new atomic age. It is clear that the dwarf wheat varieties of today are not the same as those 50 years ago. The Brodbach wheat experiment documented the change in nutritional content over the last half century. Even as grain yields skyrocketed during the Green Revolution, the micronutrient content plummeted. Today's wheat is simply not as nutritious as in previous generations. That surely cannot be good news. Another clue to wheat's changing character is the enormous increase in the prevalence of celiac disease, which is a reaction against gluten protein that damages the small intestine. Wheat is by far the predominant source of gluten in the Western diet, often by a factor of 100 or more. By comparing archived blood samples from Air Force men over a period of 50 years, researchers discovered that the prevalence of celiac disease appears to have quadrupled. Could this be a result of new wheat varieties? This question has not yet been satisfactorily answered, but the possibility is troubling. Processing methods have changed significantly over the centuries. Wheat berries were traditionally ground by large millstones powered by animals or humans. The modern flour mill has replaced traditional stone grinding. The bran, middlings, germ, and oils are efficiently and completely removed, leaving the pure white starch. Most of the vitamins, proteins, fiber, and fats are removed along with the outer hull and bran. The flour is ground to such a fine dust that its absorption by the intestine is extremely rapid. The increased rate of glucose absorption amplifies the insulin effect. Whole wheat and whole grain flours retain some of the bran and germ, but suffer from the same problem of rapid absorption. Starches are hundreds of sugars all linked together. Most, 75% of the starch found in white flour is organized into branched chains called amylopectin, the remainder into amylose. There are several classes of amylopectin, A, B, and C. Legumes are particularly rich in amylopectin C, which is very poorly digested. As the undigested carbohydrate moves through the colon, gut flora produces gas, causing the familiar tooting of the bean eater. While beans and legumes are very high in carbohydrate, much of it is not absorbed. Amylopectin B, found in bananas and potatoes, is intermediate in terms of absorption. The most easily digested is amylopectin A, found in, you guessed it, wheat. Wheat is converted to glucose more efficiently than virtually any other starch. However, despite all the concerns discussed in this chapter, observational studies consistently demonstrate that whole grains are protective against obesity and diabetes. Where is the disconnection? The answer here is fiber. The benefits of fiber. Fiber is the non-digestible part of food, usually of a carbohydrate. Common types of fiber include cellulose, hemicellulose, pectins, beta-glucans, fructans, and gums. Fiber is classified as soluble or insoluble based on whether it is dissolvable in water. Beans, oat bran, avocado, and berries are good sources of soluble fiber. Whole grains, wheat germ, beans, flaxseed, leafy vegetables, and nuts are good sources of insoluble fiber. Fiber can also be classified as fermentable or non-fermentable. Normal bacteria residing in the large intestine have the ability to ferment certain undigested fiber into the short-chain fatty acids acetate, butyrate, and propionate, which can be used as an energy source. They may also have other beneficial hormonal effects, including the decreased output of glucose from the liver. Generally, soluble fiber is more fermentable than insoluble. Fiber has multiple purported mechanisms of health, but the importance of each is largely unknown. High-fiber foods require more chewing, which may help to reduce food intake. Horace Fletcher, 1849 to 1919, believed strongly that chewing every bite of food 100 times would cure obesity and increase muscle strength. Doing so helped him lose 40 pounds, 18 kilograms, and Fletcherizing became a popular weight loss method in the early 20th century. Fiber may decrease the palatability of food and thus reduce food intake. Fiber bulks up foods and decreases its energy density. Soluble fiber absorbs water to form a gel, further increasing its volume. This effect helps fill the stomach, which increases satiety. Stomach distension may signal a sensation of fullness or satiety through the vagus nerve. Increased bulk may also mean that the stomach takes more time to empty. Therefore, after meals rich in fiber, blood glucose and insulin levels are slower to rise. In some studies, half the variance of the glucose response to starchy foods depended on their fiber content. In the large intestine, the increased stool bulk may lead to increased caloric excretion. On the flip side, fermentation in the colon may produce short-chain fatty acids. Roughly 40% of dietary fiber may be metabolized in this way. One study demonstrated that a low-fiber diet resulted in 8% higher caloric absorption. In short, fiber may decrease food intake, slow down food's absorption in the stomach and small intestine, then help it exit quickly through the large intestines, all of which are potentially beneficial in treating obesity. Fiber intake has fallen considerably over the centuries. In Paleolithic diets, it was estimated to be 77 to 120 grams per day. Traditional diets are estimated to have 50 grams per day of dietary fiber. By contrast, modern American diets contain as little as 15 grams per day. Indeed, even the American Heart Association's Dietary Guidelines for Healthy North American Adults only recommends 25 to 30 grams per day. However, removal of dietary fiber is a key component of food processing, proving the texture, taste, and consumption of foods directly increases food companies' profits. Fiber came to public attention in the 1970s, and by 1977, the new dietary guidelines recommended we eat foods with adequate starch and fiber. With that, fiber was enshrined in the pantheon of conventional nutritional wisdom. Fiber was good for you, but it was difficult to show exactly how it was good for you. At first, it was believed that high fiber intake reduced colon cancer. The subsequent studies proved to be a bitter disappointment. The 1999 prospective Nurses Health Study followed 88,757 women over 16 years and found no significant benefit in reducing colon cancer risk. Similarly, a randomized study from 2000 of high fiber intake failed to demonstrate any reduction in precancerous lesions called adenomas. If fiber wasn't helping in reducing cancer, perhaps fiber might be beneficial in reducing heart disease. The 1989 Diet and Reinfarction Trial randomized 2,033 men after their first heart attack to three different diets. To the researchers' astonishment, the American Heart Association's low-fat diet did not seem to reduce risk at all. What about a high-fiber diet? No benefit. The Mediterranean diet, which is high fat, on the other hand, was beneficial, as Dr. Ansel Keys had suspected years ago. Recent trials, such as the Pre-Dimed, confirm the benefits of eating more natural fats, such as nuts and olive oil. So eating more fat is beneficial. But it was difficult to shake the feeling that somehow fiber was good. Many correlation studies, including the Pima and Native Canadians, associate lower body mass index with high fiber intake. More recently, the 10-year observational CARDIA study found that those eating the most fiber were the least likely to gain weight. Short-term studies show that fiber increases satiety, reduces hunger, and decreases caloric intake. Randomized trials of fiber supplements show relatively modest weight loss effects, with a mean weight loss of 2.9 to 4.2 pounds, 1.3 to 1.9 kilograms, over a period of up to 12 months. Longer-term studies are not available. Fiber, the anti-nutrient. When we consider the nutritional benefits of food, we typically consider the vitamins, minerals, and nutrients contained. We think about components in the food that nourish the body. Such is not the case for fiber. The key to understanding fiber's effect is to realize that it is not as a nutrient, but as an anti-nutrient, where its benefit lies. Fiber has the ability to reduce absorption and digestion. Fiber subtracts rather than adds. In the case of sugars and insulin, this is good. Soluble fiber reduces carbohydrate absorption, which in turn reduces blood glucose and insulin levels. In one study, type 2 diabetic patients were split into two groups and given standardized liquid meals, one control group and the other with added fiber. The group that received liquid meals with added fiber reduced both the glucose and the insulin peaks, despite the fact that the two groups consumed exactly the same amount of carbohydrates and calories. Because insulin is the main driver of obesity and diabetes, its reduction is beneficial. In essence, fiber acts as a sort of antidote to the carbohydrate, which in this analogy is the poison. Carbohydrates, even sugar, are not literally poisonous, but the comparison is useful to understand fiber's effect. It is no coincidence that virtually all plant foods, in their natural, unrefined state, contain fiber. Mother Nature has prepackaged the antidote with the poison. Thus, traditional societies may follow diets high in carbohydrates without evidence of obesity or type 2 diabetes. The one critical difference is that the carbohydrates consumed by traditional societies are unrefined and unprocessed, resulting in very high fiber intake. Western diets are characterized by one defining feature, and it's not the amount of fat, salt, carbohydrate, or protein. It's the high amount of processing of foods. Consider traditional Asian markets, full of fresh meats and vegetables. Many people in Asian cultures buy fresh food daily, so processing it to extend shelf life is neither necessary nor welcome. By contrast, North American supermarkets have aisles overflowing with boxed, processed foods. Several more aisles are dedicated to processed frozen foods. North Americans will buy groceries for weeks or even months at a time. The large volume retailer Costco, for example, depends on this practice. Fiber and fat, key ingredients, are removed in the refining process. Fiber, to change the texture and make food taste better, and natural fats to extend shelf life, since fats tend to go rancid with time. And so we ingest the poison without the antidote. The protective effects of fiber is removed from much of our food. Where whole, unprocessed carbohydrates virtually always contain fiber, dietary proteins and fats contain almost none. Our bodies have evolved to digest these foods without the need for fiber. Without the poison, the antidote is unnecessary. Here again, Mother Nature has proven herself to be far wiser than us. Removing protein and fat in the diet may lead to overconsumption. There are natural satiety hormones, peptide YY, cholecystokinin, that respond to protein and fat. Eating pure carbohydrate does not activate these systems and leads to overconsumption, the second stomach phenomenon. Natural foods have a balance of nutrients and fiber that, over millennia, we have evolved to consume. The problem is not with each specific component of the food, but rather the overall balance. For example, suppose we bake a cake with a balance of butter, eggs, flour, and sugar. Now we decide to remove completely the flour and double the eggs instead. The cake tastes horrible. Eggs are not necessarily bad. Flour is not necessarily good, but the balance is off. The same holds true for carbohydrates. The entire package of unrefined carbohydrates, with fiber, fat, protein, and carbohydrate, is not necessarily bad. But removing everything except the carbohydrate destroys the delicate balance and makes it harmful to human health. Fiber and type 2 diabetes. Both obesity and type 2 diabetes are diseases caused by excessive insulin. Insulin resistance develops over time as a result of persistently high insulin levels. If fiber can protect against elevated insulin, then it should protect against type 2 diabetes, right? That's exactly what the studies show. The nurses' health studies 1 and 2 monitored the dietary records of thousands of women over many decades and confirmed the protective effect of cereal fiber intake. Women who ate a high glycemic index diet but also ate large amounts of cereal fibers are protected against type 2 diabetes. In essence, this diet is simultaneously high in poison and in antidote. The two cancel each other out with no net effect. Women who ate a low glycemic index diet, low poison, but also a low fiber diet, low antidote, were also protected. Again, the two cancel each other out. But the deadly combination of a high glycemic index diet, high poison, with low fiber, low antidote, increased the risk of type 2 diabetes by a horrifying 75%. This combination mirrors the exact effect of processing carbohydrates. Processing increases their glycemic index but decreases their fiber content. The massive 1997 Health Professionals Follow-Up Study followed 42,759 men over 6 years with essentially the same results. The diet high in glycemic load, poison, and low in fiber, antidote, increases the risk of type 2 diabetes by 217%. The Black Woman's Health Study demonstrated that a high glycemic index diet was associated with a 23% increased risk of type 2 diabetes. A high fiber intake, by contrast, was associated with an 18% lower risk of diabetes. Carbohydrates in their natural, whole, unprocessed form, perhaps with the exception of honey, always contain fiber, which is precisely why junk food and fast food are so harmful. The processing and the addition of chemicals change the food into a form that our bodies have not evolved to handle. That is exactly why these foods are toxic. One other traditional food may help protect against the modern evils of elevated insulin: vinegar. The wonders of vinegar. The word vinegar originates from the Latin words vinum acer, meaning sour wine. Wine, left undisturbed, eventually turns into vinegar, acetic acid. Ancient peoples quickly discovered vinegar's versatility. Vinegar is still in widespread use as a cleaning substance. Traditional healers exploited the antimicrobial properties of vinegar in a time before antibiotics by using it to clean wounds. Unfiltered vinegar contains mother, which consists of the protein, enzymes, and bacteria used to make it. Vinegar has long been used to preserve food by pickling. As a beverage, the tangy, sour taste of vinegar never gained much popularity, although Cleopatra was famously rumored to drink vinegar in which pearls had been dissolved. However, vinegar still retains fans as a condiment for French fries, a component in dressings, balsamic vinegar, and in making sushi rice, rice vinegar. Diluted vinegar is a traditional tonic for weight loss. Mention of this folk remedy is found as far back as 1825. British poet Lord Byron popularized vinegar as a weight loss tonic and would reportedly go for days eating biscuits and potatoes soaked in vinegar. Other ways to use vinegar are to ingest several teaspoons of it prior to meals or to drink it diluted in water at bedtime. Apple cider vinegar seems to have gained a particular following, as it contains both vinegar, acetic acid, as well as the pectins from the apple cider, a type of soluble fiber. There are no long-term data on the use of vinegar for weight loss. However, smaller short-term human studies suggest that vinegar may help reduce insulin resistance. 2 teaspoons of vinegar taken with a high-carbohydrate meal lowers blood sugar and insulin by as much as 34%, and taking it just before the meal was more effective than taking it 5 hours before meals. The addition of vinegar for sushi rice lowered the glycemic index of white rice by almost 40%. Addition of pickled vegetables and fermented soybeans, natto, also significantly lowered the glycemic index of the rice. In a similar manner, rice with the substitution of pickled cucumber showed a decrease in its glycemic index by 35%. Potatoes, served cold and dressed with vinegar as a salad, showed considerably lower glycemic index than regular potatoes. The cold storage may favor the development of resistant starch, and the vinegar adds to the benefits. Both glycemic and insulin index were reduced by 43% and 31%, respectively. The total amount of carbohydrate is the same in all cases. Vinegar does not displace the carbohydrate, but actually seems to exert a protective effect on the serum insulin response. Type 2 diabetics drinking 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar diluted in water at bedtime reduced their fasting morning blood sugars. Higher doses of vinegar also seem to increase satiety, resulting in slightly lower caloric intake through the rest of the day, approximately 200 to 275 calories less. This effect was also noted for peanut products. Interestingly, peanuts also resulted in a reduction of glycemic response by 55%. It's not known how acetic acid produces these beneficial effects. The acid may interfere with the digestion of starches by inhibiting salivary amylase. Vinegar may also reduce the speed of gastric emptying. The data is conflicting, with at least one study showing a 31% reduction in glucose response with no significant delayed gastric emptying. The use of oil and vinegar dressing is associated with lower risk of cardiovascular disease. The benefit was originally attributed to the effect of dietary alpha-linolenic acid. However, Dr. F. Hu of Harvard University points out that mayonnaise, containing similar amounts of alpha-linolenic acid, does not appear to provide nearly the same cardiac protection. Perhaps the difference here is the consumption of vinegar. While far from conclusive, it is certainly an interesting hypothesis. Just don't expect rapid weight loss with the use of vinegar. Even its proponents claim only a mild decrease in weight. The problem with the glycemic index. The classification of carbohydrate foods into the glycemic index was logical and successful. Designed originally for diabetic patients, the index helped them make food choices. However, for the treatment of obesity, low glycemic index diets have met with mixed success. Weight reduction benefits have been elusive, and that's because there is one particularly insurmountable problem with the glycemic index diet. Blood glucose does not drive weight gain, but hormones, particularly insulin and cortisol, do. Insulin causes obesity. The goal should therefore be to lower insulin levels, not glucose levels. The unspoken assumption is that glucose is the only stimulant to insulin secretion. This turns out not to be true at all. There are many factors that raise and lower insulin, especially protein. Chapter 17. Protein. In the mid-1990s, as popular sentiment began to turn against the poor, unloved carbohydrate, a backlash originated within the medical community. "Carbohydrate-reduced diets are nutritionally unbalanced," they sputtered. That sure sounded good. There are only 3 macronutrients, after all: protein, fat, and carbohydrate. Severe restriction of any one of these runs the risk of an unbalanced diet. Of course, nutritional authorities had no similar compunction about severely restricting dietary fat, but that's beside the point. Certainly, any such diet is unbalanced. The more important concern is whether such diets are unhealthy. So, for the sake of argument, let's say that carb-reduced diets are unbalanced.